Hello and welcome to How Things Grow. How Things Grow tells the stories of the people who help companies, technologies, and economic systems take off. Each episode features an interview with one of the leading growth practitioners, entrepreneurs, or experts in the world today. We dive into the stories of these folks. We talk about origins, early victories, strokes of luck, troughs of failure, and much, much more, to deconstruct many of the things they do to drive dramatic growth for their companies and technologies. How Things Grow is presented by me, Shamant Rao, the CEO of the mobile user acquisition firm Rocketship HQ. My guest today is Liam Martin, and this is a conversation about a topic that is near and dear to my heart, remote work. Liam is one of the world's foremost experts on remote work, having started a remote-only company more than a decade before it became cool to do so. He founded Time Doctor and Staff.com, doing some tremendously impactful work around productivity for remote work before founding the Running Remote Conference, a real-life, non-remote conference about remote work. Liam has seen remote work close up from its earliest days and has also seen nearly everything there is to be seen around remote work, be it culture, tracking, productivity, and growth. He's also talked to some of the foremost experts in remote work from companies of all sizes that are fully or partially remote. And there's so much that I want to dive into on this episode. I'm very excited to welcome Liam Martin to How Things Grow. Liam, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Liam, very excited to have you. Also because as a remote founder myself, I don't find a ton of resources out there about how to really be effective as a remote team. And you're somebody who's lived in the world of remote work for a long time, who's evangelized remote work and talked so much about it. I'm very excited to talk to you and dive in deeper on all things remote work. You know, I would like to start chronologically. Tell me about your path to discovering remote work.
Sure. Started 15 years ago at McGill University, which is the university that I attended for graduate school. I was teaching a course at McGill. And if you're a graduate student, one of the things that a lot of undergraduate students don't know is that most first year courses are taught by graduate students. So I was one of those people. You make pretty close to slave wages for the work that you're doing. I think it worked out to about $3 an hour for me, but I enjoyed it. And this was kind of the thing that I wanted to do with my life, which was academia. So long story short, I started with about 300 students, ended up with a little bit more than half of those by the end of the year. And I got some of the worst, I believe I got the worst professor lecturer review in the department's history. And the department was 212 years old at that point.
Wow.
So I remember walking into my supervisor's office and saying, I don't think I'm very good at this. And he said, no, you're not. And I said, so what do you think I should be doing? He said, well, you really got to get good at this teaching thing if you want to enter academia, because you're going to have to be doing it for the next 30 to 40 years. So either get better at that or figure something else out to do. So 6 weeks later, I threw a master's thesis under his door. I was out of my PhD and into the real world. And that turned into love for teaching and not necessarily lecturing. And it also turned into my first remote business, which was an online touring company. Grew that to hundreds of students throughout North America and Europe, sold that company. And then almost a week later, I went to South by Southwest. I was speaking at a conference there. South by Southwest is basically like big, huge party for nerds. Pretty much.
Yeah.
Tech related stuff. And that's where I met my co-founder. He had an app called Time Doctor, which he was just starting as an alpha. And I decided to join him. And then we've been running Time Doctor for about 9 years. And then also just in the last 2 years, we've started Running Remote, which is the conference on building and scaling remote teams, which has been very interesting for me because I've seen the evolution of remote work over the last 15 years, basically.
Yeah, you know, there's so much I want to dig into your experiences. But I'm curious, you know, when you started 15 years ago,
remote work wasn't the thing that all the cool kids were doing. So did you have skepticism?
It was called telework at that point.
Yes.
What was it? Yeah. It was called telework. Then it was called outsourcing.
Yeah.
And we still kind of use the term outsourcing, but I actually think that outsourcing is somewhat of a racist term, to be honest with you. I think outsourcing is for non-Western remote workers.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I like to call everyone remote workers, regardless of where they're located.
Sure.
And yeah, so there's been a lot of terminology that we've been using. Indeed. But in essence, right now, the cool thing is that remote work is really blowing up. It's about 7-ish% of the U.S. workforce right now, and it's projected to be 50% by 2027.
No way.
So that's in 5 years. And there's another study, actually, that just came out recently that projects it by 2026, which seems insane. So this is not just an employee perk. This is something that is going to actually completely change the way that we work.
Yeah.
I think that anyone that's investing very heavily in office space right now should probably get out, because that's going to change.
Indeed. We know of at least one office space company that's blown up. Anyway, so...
Like blown up as in collapsed or blown up as in...
Collapsed. Yeah. Anyway, so this is 15 years ago, before the trend of remote work being increasingly mainstream is as obvious as it is today. This is far before that. So why did you guys choose remote work as a model for your companies? And did you think it could be sustainable, or it could become as mainstream as it has become today?
So I didn't think it was going to become as mainstream as it's become today. And the reason why we chose it was initially cost savings. So we're bootstrapped. We have received no venture capital for our business. We have about 100 employees right now in 34 different countries all over the world. And it was the easiest way for us to be able to grow the business with the capital that we had. And we also had experience in remote work, so we were able to understand how it worked and how to execute on it properly. If you think that remote work is hard today, try doing it 10 years ago when there wasn't Zoom or Slack or any of these other tools that we have. So we understood that and we took advantage of it. But I would say today, the reason why we continue to be remote is freedom of individual movement. So I spend about 6 months out of the year traveling, and a lot of our team travels quite a bit as well. And it just affords you a different lifestyle that you wouldn't be able to have in a brick and mortar business. I talk to a lot of friends of mine that have their companies as brick and mortar businesses, and they just don't have the freedom that I do, which I really appreciate.
Yeah, indeed. Just to touch on your beginnings, you said you started your company in an era before Zoom and Slack. In the absence of many of the tools that we somewhat take for granted today, how did you solve the problems that these tools solve today? Communication primarily.
So we were using older tools. I think Skype was basically your Slack and your Zoom before Zoom and Slack really fired themselves up. But there's a lot of tools. It's interesting. I actually think probably tools like Zoom and Slack will be something else in 10 more years, and maybe actually in 5 years. So I don't think that they're going to gain the wide scale adoption that that they're looking for. I actually think today, everyone talks about conglomeration. I actually think the opposite is going to happen. So Zoom might be good for a certain group of people, but then inside of that group of people, there might be, and let's say Zoom's doing, I don't know how much Zoom is doing, hundreds of millions a year. I'm sure we could look at their IPO docs, but probably inside of, let's say, that 200 million a year, there might be 30 to 40 million a year that is perfectly connected to a different type of product. And I think that product will be built. And then it will actually, like, it's the reverse of conglomeration. You're actually going to have a whole bunch of businesses. And the reason why I believe this will occur is the cost of entry is zero, or effectively zero.
Yeah.
I can build Zoom right now. I could build a beta of Zoom for under $100,000. And that's kind of an interesting perspective that I see particularly happening in remote work, something that is going to be very interesting to see over the next couple of years, because a lot of our valuations are based off conglomeration. And if that doesn't happen, what happens to the value of those companies?
Indeed, there certainly are very many tools that are being explicitly built for remote workers. And certainly Slack and Zoom weren't necessarily built for remote work. It's a use case that has been an emergent property. So certainly I can see the trend that you speak of emerging. I'm curious, Liam, so let's assume there's a small company. They're like, oh, we have thought about going remote. We don't know if we should. What do you recommend typically as a first steps for a company that's considering remote?
How about you give me a little bit more data? How many people do they have in their company? Let's get, if we really want to boil down to it, because it's dependent upon the company size.
Sure. So, I would say let's take one of my friends' startups, right? Some of my friends, they're in New York or San Francisco. They have like 20 to 30 people. They're like, well, we have 30 people. We're growing. We're doing well. Is this remote thing for us? They're contemplating this. These are real questions that real people I know are asking themselves. So what do you typically recommend as first steps?
So first thing that I would suggest, if you've got 20 to 30 people in an office, I would experiment with one of two things. Either take one employee remote or do remote Fridays. And it's really up to you. The reason why you would take one person remote is to see whether that person can silo off of the rest of that group and operate more efficiently. It's a great way to be able to test somebody. If you're going to do that, you need to be able to take an employee that's already doing the same task as some employees inside of your brick and mortar company. So a customer support agent or a sales rep, an AE, an SDR, a BDR, those types of people, because those are the people that you'll be able to measure very quantifiably against your control group, which is your employees inside of the office. In about 95% of cases that I've found, the remote worker works more efficiently than the brick and mortar employee. And once that occurs, the CEO very quickly recognizes, well, we should probably be moving everyone remote because we've got a 40% productivity increase, as an example, in our sales team, those types of things. The Friday remote is one that seems to be the one that starts to happen more often, and it's mostly just from requests from staff that just want to spend their Fridays remote, as an example, or their Mondays remote, whatever it might be. I don't feel that's as good of a measure because Friday remotes almost seem like an added holiday, and it's not treated in the same way as a direct remote relationship. But either one, you can get started. Once you implement that, let's say you have the full-time remote worker, the next thing you need to do is process documentation. And that's something that a lot of people don't really pay attention to. However, it is absolutely mission critical for your overall success. If you go to about.gitlab.com/handbook, you can go and see my friend Dimitri's handbook for GitLab. Dimitri's the CTO and co-founder of GitLab, and he has a 3,200-page remote process document that you can actually fork right off of GitLab. So it's pretty easy, and he has absolutely everything in there. If you are interested in using something like GitLab, Google Docs is a really cheap, easy solution. Basically, write out all of the things that your company does. Start with the things that are the biggest time sucks for you. So if for most people, it would be like how to batch jump or how to answer customer support tickets or proper documentation inside of your SaaS application, those types of things, and then get other people to consume it and understand it, and you're off to the races. Another honorable mention actually mentioned is Trainual. If you want a paid version of something like Google Docs or GitLab, Trainual is really good, and it's purpose-built specifically for process documentation.
Interesting. Yeah, I think that's been one of my learnings as a remote founder, which is that how important the processes are, which is I didn't quite register when I was starting out. Thankfully, some of our advisors have been great in making sure our processes have been
solid. The difference between an entrepreneur and an executive. And most people, I would consider myself an entrepreneur, but I am trying to become an executive. as much as possible. So entrepreneurs go to 0 to 1, and then an executive goes from 1 to 10. And usually an entrepreneur is not a very good executive. And also an executive isn't a very good entrepreneur. So how do you start a business? It's a completely different set of skills that you need to convince someone to buy something from you that doesn't exist yet versus something that already exists, and then just scaling that process. And so that's been a huge learning for me, which is if I want to get to the next stage of the company, I either need to become an executive or hire executives.
Yeah, indeed. Certainly a learning phase that I'm going through myself too. But going back to a hypothetical small company, they said, right, let's have 1% remote, or let's have Friday remote Fridays. They're experimenting with this, right? How do you suggest that a company like this handles some of the cultural challenges with going remote? For instance, the 20 to 30 people they've hired, they signed up for an office job where they can go to a water cooler, they can go out for lunch with their friends, they can go out for happy hour. That's the work culture they've signed up for. And now either the founder or the senior executives are like, well, we're going to go fully remote.
Right.
That's how do you recommend that an executive or an entrepreneur handle that transition from a cultural perspective?
Well, that's a cultural decision too, right? So if your employees say, we don't like this and we don't want to do this, then you shouldn't do it, or you should find new employees. But if you have a headcount of 20 people and you announce to everyone, we're going to go remote, or who would like to go remote, I could bet you 18 out of 20 of them will sign up and say yes. It is the most requested job perk for millennials. Okay. And Generation Zs, which are the generation below millennials, in the tech space, 3 out of 5 of them are full-time remote right now. So we're seeing a massive wave in comparison to the data point that I gave you at the beginning of our talk, which was 7.9% of the U.S. workforce is remote. You can see that that's almost entirely in the younger generations. It's not in the older generations. So if you've got someone who's 55, maybe that person is going to be a little bit resistant towards remote work agreements. But I mean, we have 60-year-olds in the company that work for us, and they love going remote. It's just requires a little bit more of an adjustment phase. I'm friends with a remote consultant who specifically takes large corporate companies remote. And it was very interesting to chat with her because she had to do 4 weeks of training for these 2,000 employees on how to use Zoom.
Oh, wow.
Because they had never used it before. But for me, I would have thought, well, why do you need to train someone on how to use Zoom? Yeah. You just click a button and you start it. But these things need to be overcome, particularly for people that don't have experience in remote work.
Yeah. Something else that some founders, some entrepreneurs think about, especially those who've been in non-remote environments for most of their working lives, is what happens to my team's productivity? They're not going to slack off. You built a business around productivity, at least one that I know of.
Yep.
How do you recommend thinking about this or addressing this for a founder or an entrepreneur?
So I think you need some type of measurement when you have an opportunity to really focus on quantitative output. So, you know, let's say you're hiring a Facebook ads person. Mm-hmm. What's the ROAS on that particular Facebook ads person? Is it good or is it bad? What's your cost of acquiring a customer? Are we doing it profitably? All of these metrics are pretty black and white. And you either hire the person and they accomplish that task or they don't accomplish that task. Mm-hmm. And same thing for salespeople. You have a CRM. Same thing for customer support reps. You should have a report of what's the NPS score of everyone that you touched. What's the expansion revenue connected to those people that you've touched? We use a tool called Time Doctor, which is the one that I built, and it measures time connected to all of those different factors. So it basically adds time analytics on top of your HubSpot deployment. Mm-hmm. So you'd be able to know, well, why does one person close more deals than another person? And we can analyze that and figure out what the differences are. But at the end of the day, it's just you need to measure output. And in brick and mortar businesses, I am blown away at how many businesses do not measure output. they just kind of hire someone, and then 6 to 12 months later, they don't seem to really be doing a good job, but we just kind of leave them in the position and they work in that position. That's how really, you know, that's how fat is built inside of a business. You need to cut that out.
Indeed.
As possible.
I would say as a remote founder, being remote has almost forced me to measure things that I wouldn't have done in a non-remote business. Right. Which is so interesting. I was just telling my team, I've been in at least two very big companies, multi-million dollar companies. They didn't have project management tools. And I was like, we as a five-person team too, right? So which to me shocked me once I stopped to think about it. And we talked about a hypothetical small company that's looking to go remote. Let's assume there's a company that is remote, either they've transition successfully or they've just started off as a fully remote team. How do you recommend they think about culture? Do you recommend they, you know, let's say the founder, perhaps someone like myself, that's like, right, I have a remote team. I want to make sure my remote team's culture is great. People are excited to come into work. People are motivated to work because they're smart. They like what they do. But I want to make sure I'm intentional about shaping culture. What might be a few things this founder could do?
Right. So I love this term culture because I think it's thrown around so much and it's very rarely defined precisely.
Yes.
So, and there's a lot of different ways that you can define culture. But for me, a really great way to communicate culture is what do we do that will appear weird or odd to others? So we work remotely. Most people don't work remotely, so that's personally connected to our culture. We measure everything inside of our organization. Right now I'm measuring the call with you. It adds into all of the different podcasts that I've done over the last 2 years, and I will very easily be able to measure this podcast's effectiveness in comparison to all the other podcasts that I've done. That's weird for me and for our culture. So number one, you really just have to define where your weird is. What do you do that's unique to you as an organization or very rare to you that not many people would necessarily agree with you upon? Once you have that in place, those are the pieces that for us, from a remote perspective, you haven't had that much difficulty with. A lot of the things that make remote culture kind of functional are actually huge advantages for employees. So as an example, we do a team retreat every year. So everyone in the company comes to one location once a year, and it's usually about a week, and we talk about everything that we want to talk about connected to our business, remote work, and then the future of all of the companies that we have. And it's almost kind of like, think of it as like a company conference, fundamentally. Mm-hmm. It's just like a conference on what we're doing. That's really fun. Everyone looks forward to that every single year. It's incredibly expensive, costs hundreds of thousands of dollars to be able to do each year. But for us, we find it is a fantastic ROI. We do other things like we do video games once a week. So it's a voluntary group that you can become part of. And you can join a video game group like Dota or a lot of first-person shooters, strategy games, that type of thing. But the only requirement that we have is that you have an open mic so you can communicate with your other team members.
Right.
And the vast majority of the conversation is not actually about work, but about 10% of it is. And that's the overlap that you start end up having. And we have smaller things like we have a Slack channel that's just the water cooler chat, and we have birthday celebrations on Basecamp, those types of things. But fundamentally, all of those things end up producing a much more happier work environment.
Yeah, but let's say there's a founder who has never worked in a remote environment, starting something new that's fully remote. Where might they begin when it comes to, oh, should we set up video game nights? Should we set up virtual happy hours, which we did, which we do,
right,
which is fun, which is great. Where should they begin? How should they think about this?
I think you should ask your team, and you should maybe present a couple different options, like, do you guys want to do team retreats? Do you guys want to do happy hours? Do you want to do this? And then actually just survey them and ask them, you give them all these options and then ask them to rank them.
Right.
That's a really important thing. I mean, I get that from marketing, obviously.
Yeah.
If you
yeah.
say, well, would you like a team retreat? Yes, I would. Okay, would you like this coffee cup? Yes, I would. It's just, yeah. you know, whatever you say that you're going to give an employee, they're going to take, but you need to be able to rank them. That's super important right. to be able to figure out where they're at.
Right, right. I think that, yeah, define the universe of possibilities and have them rank it. I think that makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to hiring for a remote-only role, one of the challenges that many face, myself included, is that the candidate pool is usually full of people who haven't had a lot of remote experience. How do you recommend thinking about hiring for a remote-only role in this context?
It's hard right now. I got to tell you, I've been cheating because with running remote, we get a whole bunch of candidates that have a ton of experience. So it's not something that we've experienced recently. So in terms of just finding people, I would say probably your best bang for your buck is remote. Okay. We work remotely, remotive.io and FlexJobs. And yeah. honorable mention actually would be a Dribbble for design yeah. people. So awesome. If you look to, if you go to those different job boards, those are all job boards specifically for remote workers. So they right. all have experience and we've right. put up postings and honestly, we're, on average now, I think we're seeing about 400 to 500 responses if we post in all of those different platforms. So it's a ton of funnel that's coming in and those remote workers now know, well, I'm going to get a remote first company if I'm looking on these job boards.
Indeed. Yeah. One of the challenges also is during the hiring process, when you're interviewing, you're basically talking to them on Zoom like this.
Yep.
One of the areas where a lot of executives and entrepreneurs have some hesitation about is they're like, oh, you don't really get to know somebody just via talking on Zoom. Are there things that you recommend doing during the hiring process to make sure that a remote hire is as effective as somebody you would hire in a non-remote context?
I would say our hit rate is probably the same when I've compared it to other people, but we do ask a few different types of questions mm-hmm. that a lot of other people didn't necessarily ask. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest ones that we've started asking recently is the Peter Thiel question. Important truth, do very few people agree with you on?
Uh-huh. Why is that important in this specific context? There's justifications he gives, but why do you find it important?
Well, we need people that are going to zig instead of zag inside of our organization. And for us, it's critical, at least, I mean, even at 100 people, we're primarily an innovation company at the end of the day. We're not really the game, whoever can innovate the fastest usually is the one that's going to win. And so if someone has some strong views that they truly believe are correct, and something like, what if someone has like really horrific views, like some negative racial views or something like that? And obviously I've never gotten any of those before, but if anyone has really strong views that they can defend and they think a lot of people don't agree with them upon that particular view, it's going to be quite interesting to bring that person into the organization because number one, they have the ability to actually put forward ideas that they know are unpopular, but we can test those assumptions inside of the market. And then secondarily, they actually are thinking.
Right.
You'd be blown away at how many people don't really think on a regular basis. They kind of just, the vast majority of the thoughts that go through people's minds are just kind of agreement with things and they don't check anyone's math. And I like people that check people's math. Even me, you know, this is one of the things that has been constant inside of the marketing department. People are not challenging me on my assumptions, then why are they there?
Indeed.
Because we need to actually build fast growing organizations. So, we asked that question. We asked questions that really connect to remote work in a much deeper way. So do you actually like remote work? That's one of the questions that a lot of people don't ask. They always assume. And if it's that in for me with us, I remember this one guy, his resume looked amazing. And he said, I don't really like remote work. I think that remote work is not useful and I don't agree with it. And I just stopped the interview right there because obviously we didn't need to work together past that point because he sells software specifically for remote teams. Those types of things are just some of the standard things that you would ask.
Yeah. One of the things that I'm fascinated by around the evolution of remote work lately is how some very large companies are fully remote now. There's Automatic that I've heard of. Dribbble, Zach, who is on this podcast, spoke quite a bit about how they've managed to be fully remote. And there's GitLab, which I also understand is a fairly big organization. Can you speak to what some of the ways are in which processes and infrastructure have to change as a company grows to, let's say, 500 plus people? Because, you know, with a 20-person team, it's somewhat manageable. There's one set of processes that work when you're 20 people. I don't believe the exact same things will work when you have 500 people or 1,000 people. Can you speak to what needs to evolve and change?
There's a couple of general HR kind of bumps that you'll get. So the first one is more than 7 people. And you can watch this at a party. Next time you go to a party with 30 to 40 people at it, watch a group of 7 people. And then watch what happens when one more person enters the group of 7 people. Within about 2 minutes, they will divide into two groups. So, and that management, it's actually a management number that we use. So any employee inside of the company can't manage more than 7 people. And also it's just an org chart kind of bump that you need to be able to look at. So no one can sit at a table anymore. Once you're past 7, it really kind of turns into 2 tables. And that's your first example of siloing. People is another bump, at least in our case, where you really start to see departments start to pop up inside of an organization. I actually think that's the first point in which you can really start to call yourself a CEO. I'm blown away at how many people call themselves the CEO and there's like 2 people in the company. It's like, well, no, you're just the founder of the business and there's 2 other people that work for you. And then another one that we've been hitting up against is the Dunbar number. So that's between 100 and 150 people. And that is a sociological number that connects to how many people you can personally know inside of any organization. And that's generally between 100 and 150 people. And we're currently at that cap right now. We are purposefully actually trying to hold ourselves at that cap as much as possible, because past that point, you really start to treat people as numbers and not necessarily as human beings. And that is not a negative or positive statement. That is just an agnostic statement. That's the reality of what will happen. You think that you're going to be able to know the sales guys down the hallway from you, or you know, at the next team retreat or something like that. But in reality, that's not the way it happens. This was the first year, this past team retreat was the first year that people came into the company that I didn't hire, my manager didn't hire, but my manager's manager hired. And they didn't even know me, which actually was another process document that we added in, which was a high-level org chart to communicate to everyone, here are the founders of the business, here's how they founded this business, here's how, you know, they connect to all that kind of stuff. It was quite funny because I had a chat with about 4 of them, these new recruits, and they didn't know who I was. And I got a whole bunch of really nasty information from other people because they thought that I just worked there. I wasn't the founder of the business. So those are the big ones that you need to be prepared for. Anything else, if it's currently working for you, I wouldn't necessarily think about changing it, but I would say 7, 20, 50, and then 100 plus. Those are the major barriers that you need to kind of do a reorganization for. If you don't, as an example, have all your process documentation in place at 100 people, you will never make it to 500, guaranteed.
Yeah, understandable. You know, something that's also a factor that's prevalent with a lot of remote work is just because a lot of people are working by themselves, it's easy to stay in your cave, never go out. So as a founder or an entrepreneur, how would you go about preempting this, right? Not necessarily let this become a big problem, but are there ways in which you would think about at least addressing it or alleviating it before it becomes a problem?
Alleviating just kind of the social aspects to it?
Yeah, the social aspect to it. How are there things that as a remote founder you could do to make sure people don't suffer the adverse effects of working all by themselves without social Yeah.
So we've done something unique inside of the company, which is HR has built the executive team has implemented a fire organization. So what that means is if you work for us, you can come to HR in suicide problem inside of the company, or I'm feeling very depressed, or there was a death in the family and I can't work anymore. You know, these types of things. And HR does not have to report it back. So HR's top metric is retention. That's mm-hmm. their top metric that they're looking for. It is not how cost effective the team is. And so what we've realized is this is a better way for us to be able to reach out to any of the employees inside of the organization saying, well, you really don't want to tell your manager that you're super depressed mm-hmm. because that might get you fired, but you can talk to HR about it and you will not get fired. Think of them almost as like in-team therapists as opposed yeah. to, they're not licensed therapists, obviously, but think mm-hmm. of them in that context where they are not going to tell your manager under yeah. any circumstances whatsoever. That seems to have worked quite well. We've had, over the last year, our HR team has told me of at least half a dozen instances of real kind of, I guess, negative thoughts or depression, yeah. these types of things that people are dealing with. And they've communicated that to HR successfully. And we see that as a win out of any circumstance, anytime someone reports that to us.
Indeed. I like the way you speak of HR as almost a in-team therapist, so to speak. Yeah. To change gears a bit, right? Something around which there isn't a lot of data documentation is how to think about compensation when your teams are in five different continents. There's one school of thought that's like, well, it should be tied to the cost of living. There's another that says, well, it should be market rate. It's another matter. So how you would define it? How would you recommend thinking about this?
It's an interesting debate, isn't it? There are equally successful people on either side that do it both ways. Me personally, we define a flat rate. So we say we are going to hire the best developer that we can afford at 6,000 US per month. Okay. And where is that person located on planet Earth? That's all that we looked at. So whether that, if that person is in San Francisco, they're probably not making that much. They could probably find a much better job somewhere else because they can get paid more than $6,000 a month. If they're in middle America, that's probably pretty good. If they're in Canada, that's probably pretty good. If they're in Ukraine, we're probably going to get the absolute top tier 0.1% of developers in that location. So we just put out the posting and we are location agnostic. There are other people that have the reverse, which say, we're just going to hire someone and then we're going to adjust their salary based off of their location. However, I found the majority of those remote companies are usually mostly US based. So if you have like somebody that's in New York and they want to move to San Francisco and maybe they get a 10% bump, that's cool. But if you have someone that's in Ukraine that wants to move to San Francisco, me as an example, I get paid $6,000 per month. I don't think I've ever said that on a podcast, but that's how much I pay myself. And then if I wanted to move to San Francisco, I would probably have to triple that to really have the same lifestyle that I would need here.
Sure.
That I currently experience. So it all kind of just boils down to what do you want to do? I like the agnostic perspective because it allows for me to be able to do talent acquisition in places that you wouldn't have otherwise been able to do talent acquisition. And because we're very well adjusted towards remote work agreements, yeah, it's very easy for us to hire a whole bunch of people out of some country in Africa that I can't remember right now. Mm-hmm. And we hired them because they were the absolute best email marketers on planet Earth. Wow. And they were more cost effective than anyone in the US, but more importantly, they were more effective. Yeah. So that's where we hired them.
Indeed. Just switch gears a bit. I know you talked about you're running the remote conference, mm-hmm, that started about 2 years ago. I will ask the obvious question, which is, why have an in-person conference about remote work?
Get that a lot.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Same reason why we do team retreats every single year. Okay. So for us, it is the point of the conference is we want to build a playbook on remote work. So within the next, and I think we're actually already in the process of completing that, but within the next 2 to 3 years, we hopefully will have enough accumulated knowledge that we could double the acceleration of a remote company in terms of from zero to, let's say, year five, right? So we could tell you what you need to do on year one, year two, year three, year four, year five to be able to make that company more successful. And so that's the first goal. You need to actually see people in person to be able to really understand that in an effective way. And then number two is everyone needs a collaboration space. So how do you actually go in and understand best practices? One of the best ways to do that is with a physical conference as opposed to a remote conference. Because for me, conferences are really just, they're 10% watching the talks and 90% the conversations around the talks.
Agreed. And when you first started running remote, how did you attract speakers and attendees?
Through luck. So we... mostly it was through my personal network, to be honest with you. It was kind of begging a whole bunch of people that I knew were huge influencers in remote work to come. Mm-hmm. And you really need to be able to get a couple big names. And then that's pretty much all you need. So just to kind of bring you back to year one, we got Joel Gascoigne, who's the CEO of Buffer. We got Dimitri, who is the CTO and founder of GitLab. We got Amir, who is the founder of Todoist. So those three people said yes, and then everyone else basically just kind of locked into place because they were going. And I wish I could communicate some type of a hack to be able to make that work, but the hack is you need to not be a dick for about 10 years. You need to work hard at your job. You need to be so good that people can't ignore you. And then you need to make an ask to people to say, hey, Indeed. Would you be interested in coming to this conference? That's the reality of what you need to do.
Indeed. Yeah. I'm not suggesting that this flip the switch hack, but certainly makes sense.
I wish there was. That would be great.
Oh, well, if there was, everybody would be doing it. So maybe not. Yeah. So what are some of the things that you've learned from the conference that you didn't think of or weren't aware of?
Biggest thing that I learned from the conference, which is very counterintuitive, is I've been exposed to the absolute experts in remote work. I'm very fortunate. I think I've exposed myself to more remote work experts than anyone on planet Earth. So I've been able to kind of like talk to them and the conclusion that surprised me the most is there are equally successful businesses that have completely different strategies towards building remote teams. So mm-hmm. I've been looking at this. It's very weird. Like some people say we're currently looking at each other on this podcast. We're on Zoom when we're on a video call. There are some people that say that video calls are ridiculous and you should not have video calls under any circumstances whatsoever. There are some people that believe that synchronous communication is the absolute best way to do it and everyone should be online all the time and you should be able to communicate as quickly as possible. Other people believe that asynchronous communication, meaning there's a very specific time in which you meet and then everything else you shut down, your Slack and your Zoom and all other forms of kind of immediate communication, and you get down into doing deep work. all these different strategies. So I've come to this conclusion, which is everyone's doing different stuff because no one knows the actual best practices because remote work is so new. No one knows what they're doing. However, because remote work is such a huge productivity advantage,
right?
On average, it's going to be probably a 40% productivity boost when you add in like employee efficiency and cost savings. It's so much more productive that it doesn't really matter that everyone's getting it wrong,
right?
Because you actually net out a positive every single time. So that's kind of an interesting understanding that I've had of it, which also means there's massive opportunities for remote teams to get a lot more efficient.
Indeed. Yeah. And you know, as long as they're intentional about why they're doing what they're doing, or if whatever they're doing is aligned with their culture, they're like, look, we want to not be synchronous. And that's because that's how our teams like it. I imagine that works for them. So there's no size solve strategy. But I think it's fascinating that a lot of this is still evolving, still growing. And I'm excited to find out where remote work goes next.
Me too. I think that it's going to be very exciting to see whether or not we're actually going to hit those numbers that they're projecting for 2027. I personally don't believe it. And I'm an expert at it.
Yeah.
That feels weird for me to say, but I definitely know a lot more than most people. And I don't see those numbers as possible, but these are brains in jars that are doing these projections. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens in the next couple of years.
Indeed, Leon. Indeed. Leon, we've come up on time. So it's perhaps a good time for us to start to wrap. I'm curious if you had any closing thoughts or anything you would like to share with our listeners. Anything else?
If I can leave people with one more thought, it's that remote work isn't an employee perk anymore. It's going to be the majority of the way that we work. And if you do not understand how to implement remote work agreements and build remote first companies, you are going to be at a massive tactical disadvantage very, very quickly. And that's something that if you're running a business right now and it's not remote or you don't have a remote work agreement, I would say within the next 18 months, you should be doing it because the opportunity will pass you by.
Indeed. Yep. So great to have you, Liam, on How Things Grow. Thank you so much for taking the time to be here. I can't wait to put this out into the world very, very soon.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Hey, guys. This is Shamant again. Before you go, I have a small but very important favor to ask. If you get any pleasure or inspiration from this episode, could you please leave a review on your favorite podcasting platform, be it iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast fix? This podcast is very much a labor of love. It makes no money, and each episode takes many, many hours to put together. When you leave a rating or write a review, it not only means a great deal of encouragement to me, but it also supports getting the word out about How Things Grow. Thank you again for listening, and I look forward to seeing you with the next episode. Thank you.